thank you, Michael.
We're actually going to move on to the question and answer now with the questions posted online. And I think what I'll do, Michael, is start with the questions for you since you just wrapped up, as long as your presentation is fresh in everybody's minds.
Okay.
And so the first question is, how did ARC mitigate the freight EJ issue in Barrow County?
Well, in Barrow County, we were not able to have an alternative route chosen. So what we did is we worked with a couple different air quality partners in the Atlanta region, the Georgia Conservancy. They have a group called Mothers and Others for Clean Air, and we also worked with the Georgia EPD, Environmental Protection Division, to write in some recommendations into some air quality mitigation recommendations into the final recommendations of our study. You know, we didn't make any recommendations as far as like moving populations or anything like that, but it accounted for construction and future land use that could help with that population.
Okay. Can you please explain why a community that has poverty with differing race conflicts would be different in the analysis?
Well, you know, we just, could you repeat that question? Explain why
A community that has poverty with differing race conflicts would be different in the analysis.
So I'm assuming that would be different than a racial presence with no poverty. I'm going to take the question that way. Well, the reason we have that is that, poverty, regardless of race, puts you in an environment or puts you in a vulnerable position. But, you know, with the, federal regulations for environmental justice, we also take into consideration that many minority groups are often more adversely impacted by transportation and other things than non environmental justice groups. That is just showing what we try to do was show that it's more than one group being affected there. It wasn't necessarily a rank order, but trying to show more than one group.
And I guess that some clarification was typed in. Why would the community that has poverty with one race conflict be different than two race conflicts or three race conflicts?
Right. That's not necessarily. We weren't ranking them, saying that if there was only one race conflict, then that was okay, or then that was enough. It's just we just wanted to account for all the different communities, and we could have just had a ranking system that said poverty, race, age, and that's it. But we decided to separate those all out. But we didn't rank them. It wasn't three was worse than one or so.
Okay. I'll ask one more question to you, and then I'm going to move on to the next presenter, even though we have a few more questions, just to make sure we have time to get through some questions for everybody. But did you incorporate interregional freight flows into the AstroMap analysis?
Yes, we did. We looked at truck numbers, and probably more importantly, what we were interested in is talking to the carriers and seeing what routes they were using. We did a lot of outreach. You know, we actually talked with Coca-Cola, with Dwayne and his group extensively about what routes they used, what were the best routes, what were the ones to avoid. We had FAF data and Global Insights, the Transurge data available, that we looked at those freight flows. But we weren't sticking strictly to those because we were also trying to figure out, okay, where do we want those flows to go in the future? We looked at the best roadways that could accommodate those in terms of the roadway characteristics like lane widths and travel speeds and things like that, and also you know, their access to freight generating areas.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to move on to some questions for Chip next, and then we'll go to Dwayne, and then if we have time, we'll come back to the questions that are remaining for you, Michael. But let's see here. The first question is, I'm curious if President Obama's goal to double exports is by weight or value, or what is it by? And any more information on this goal would be of interest.
Yeah, I think with from looking at the questions, I think that one of the other attendees addressed that or mentioned that was in a State of Union address. But I think that it was the intent was to have that be doubled by value, was the focus on that.
Okay. What efforts, if any, does FHWA work with freight facilities to support local hiring in those communities that could be burdened by emissions, especially EJ communities, from freight industry? Are those populations that live in large truck and rail areas employed in those jobs?
Yeah, I would say that with the issue of environmental justice communities, or just in general employing local community residents at freight facilities, I think that generally speaking is more of a local or a regional issue in terms of addressing that. And in terms of, it may vary from location to location in terms of how that's being addressed. I would say in terms of current employment, there are some residents that live near the freight facilities. We'll just use the example of water ports. I think that's probably, at least for me, is one that's sort of easy to visualize. There are some residents that do work in those freight facilities that live in the communities adjacent to them, but I think many do not. I think what we've seen is that generally there is not as close of a tie as there used to be years ago. Between people working at freight facilities or working, we'll just say at ports or rail yards or whatnot, and people living in communities. I think that, going back many years ago, the transportation system, I'll say just generally speaking, but the transportation system maybe not being, I'm thinking like World War II, before that it wasn't as well developed. You had people live closer to where they work, and I don't think we have that quite as much now. I think there are some people that do live in those communities that work there, but I'd say that it's relatively small number of people that do that.
Okay. This question was actually asked before you gave your slide on, I think, the Freight Village in Texas, but the question is, several cities have talked about creating freight villages, but I have not found any that have been implemented. Are you aware of any? And I know that Howie Mann from the NYMTC provided a link to their report that listed some villages, but Chip, I'll open it up to you if anything else that you're aware of.
Sure. There's a couple that, besides the Alliance Texas example, that I'm at least somewhat familiar with. I wouldn't say I'm overly familiar with them. But one would be, I believe this is what's considered to be a freight village, is called, I believe it's called Center Point, which is out in the Chicago area near Joliet, Illinois. That's one location that's being developed. I think that's actually a facility where there's actually, many of you probably that are on the call realize that Chicago is an area where you have a lot of the major freight railroads. They have some of their hubs there. All the freight railroads have their hubs there. So that's a site that, or a location where there would be, I think Center Point being one of the examples where they could have a freight village. I think Center Point is considered a freight village. Another one, which I'm not sure if with Howie's study, because it's in the New York metro area, that I don't know if it would be considered a freight village, at least according to the study you did, but would be, I think it would be best described being the Perth Amboy area, which is a little bit south of New York City. It's in New Jersey, Perth Amboy, New Jersey, near where the Outer Borough, Outer Bridge connects New Jersey with Staten Island. There's a freight facility or freight village there, although I don't know if there's any residential development as part of that. I do know that there's definitely multimodal freight access at that particular facility. So those are a couple I'm at least somewhat familiar with. But I would recommend that the study that that Howie did for NIMTEC, I think, would probably be a particularly good source to get information, since they've rounded up that information.
Okay. Well, thank you, Chip.
Sure.
I think now we'll move on to some questions for Dwayne. And let's see here. First question is, what role does Coca-Cola have in ensuring truck operators follow local idling ordinances intended to improve air quality?
Well, I guess the short answer for that is we follow whatever ordinance, if there are towns or ordinances, and obviously the new clean diesels that we're replacing, those are all certified clean idle vehicles, so we're following any local ordinance on that.
Thank you. I know we have a question from Abby in there. I'm going to come back to that and put that out to all presenters in a few minutes. But the next question specific to Coke is, does Coke participate in any freight stakeholder working groups or freight planning committees?
Absolutely. And as Michael said, he's worked with us and we've worked with him. That's the Atlanta Regional Commission is one that we have and gave our input on. And we would obviously be interested in helping out anyone else that we could if you have needs in your area.
Okay. What percent of Coke's deliveries are made in the off hours?
That is something I do not know. I couldn't give you a number percent-wise, but I would, if I had to, based on my knowledge in the Southeast, I would have to say that it's about 15%, and that's just a wild guess. But it's going to be somewhere under 25% on that.
Okay. And does Coke have a policy on raising the gas tax, similar to General Motors CEO, who suggested a $1 a gallon increase to encourage use of alternative fuels, electric vehicles, transit, walkability?
Nothing that I'm aware of. I've not heard any information of a position at all that we have on the gas tax.
Do customers who accept off-peak hour deliveries receive a discount?
No, and I saw that question. That's probably a good idea. That is, we have not approached that to any of our customers yet, but there's certainly things like that are certainly things that we could carry to our customers and see how receptive they would be to it.
Okay. I'll ask you this next question, but Chip or Michael, I'll invite you to jump in as well. And I guess, this, you know, first from Coke's standpoint, can you name two cities in the U.S. that have done a good job of providing truck routes to deliver consumer goods to their residents? And I'm particularly interested in examples where they have worked through conflicts.
From Coke's standpoint, unfortunately, I can't say that those cities exist. That they're probably very well could be there, and I'm not aware of them, but I couldn't name you two examples where someone's did a really good job of planning that ahead.
Okay. The one that, this is Michael Craig, the one that I know about is New York City. They have a they've created their own truck route network, and it's pretty extensive. And there was a lot of the, you know, the stuff that they had to go through with, you know, people saying we don't want trucks through here, we don't, you know, because I don't know many people who live in neighborhoods that want trucks coming through their neighborhoods. So I know New York did a good job with that.
Okay, thank you.
I was just gonna say, I think Mike, you can probably toot your own horn a little bit. I think although it may not be necessarily directly answering the question, I think that the effort that Atlanta Regional Commission did in terms of identifying truck routes is maybe not exactly what is being asked in the question, but I think it does definitely touch on that in terms of trying to identify where the key truck routes are based on the needs within the region. So I think that Atlanta might be considered an example as well.
And we did have to work through some issues too. We did do quite a bit of public outreach as well as industry outreach, and particularly in the city of Atlanta, there were some neighborhoods that we had to work with and to accommodate them and accommodate the trucks, and we were able to do that.
Okay, thank you. Back to Dwayne, what is Coke's position relative to truck-only toll lanes?
Don't know that we have a position on that. That's something that's really in our region, I guess, formally being talked about for the past maybe year or so around this area. And I can't say that we have a position on that either way. We're obviously just up to, if that's what it requires, and that's the best thing for everyone overall, I think we would probably support that.
Okay, thank you. How does Coke allocate time for each delivery differently by the density of the area served? Is it more time allocated per delivery for dense environments or more rural environments?
It is more time for the more urban environments, and the way we do that within the software that predictively tells what a driver's route should be that day, we slow the truck speed down rather than going at it. We have a set miles per hour which is very reduced from the posted speed limit. For instance, if the posted speed limit within the city of Atlanta was 45, we're probably going to drop that on an average about 10 miles per hour. And then we start from that as a base, and that's 100% of speed. But if it's a very, very, very dense area and we've experienced problems there and we already have knowledge of that, we might drop it to 75% of our speed, not the posted speed limit. So we reduce the speed that truck will go on paper by those factors.
Okay. Next question is, off-peak hour delivery is advantageous to the customer as well as most. This is also their off-peak hour. On the other hand, they probably have less staff and might not be able to leave the front of the store to accept the delivery. How do most businesses deal with this security issue? And Duane, I don't know if you can answer that from Coke's standpoint, but then also Chip and Michael, if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, from our end of it, I mean, that security is always an issue to the stores. That is one of the reasons that some of the major retailers don't want to have someone in their store just to receive a few. But what we found is most of the places that we are able to get that off-peak hour delivery in is in a more dense, more well-lighted, more populous area, and it all depends on the volume of that store. If that store is very busy all the time, they're going to have a need to have more employees there at night as well, so it works out to where they already have people on staff. But that is certainly one of the concerns, one of the reasons that we don't have more customers on that.
For Michael, any thoughts?
I mean, my understanding of off-peak deliveries is all about the shipper. It's about who's getting the deliveries. It's not about the carrier. It's not, you know, Coke's not the one who is deciding when they're going to deliver it. It's who's going to do it. So, but I don't know anything about the safety of it.
Yeah, I'm not particularly knowledgeable about specific examples, but my understanding is that there are some receivers, some stores that may have secured areas in terms of allowing off-peak deliveries, that they don't necessarily have to have staff or at least as many staff on duty to receive the deliveries. I don't know about specific examples though.
Okay. I'm going to actually go back up here to a question that was posted and kind of open it up to all three presenters to give us your thoughts. And actually, this might be more Michael and Chip than anything else. But one special challenge we're seeing in built-out New England is complaints about freight locomotive idling near established residents due to increased track congestion. Inadequate capacity in yards, locomotives not equipped with automatic engine start-stop technology, and crew understaffing. Locomotives are idling for days and weekends, regardless of season, in absence of crew, mainly to obviate need to perform four-hour brake tests upon startup. More public and private funding for loco AESS, sidetrack rehab construction, and yard expansion would help, but money is scarce. Any ideas?
Well, this. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Okay, I was going to say I don't necessarily have specific ideas. I would say, and this might be stuff that you already know, but one of the challenges there is that when you're talking about freight rail, that it's all, you know, the freight for the railroads are privately almost, well, all the major railroads and most of the smaller railroads are privately owned. So it makes it a little more difficult in terms of trying to, to say, well, you know, this is what you need to do in terms of, you know, reducing idling and whatnot. I do know that that some railroads are looking into developing alternative power or hybrid engines to reduce emissions. Although I know that those engines, I think their intent is to try to operate them mainly in their rail yards for rail yard movements. I also know that many railroads are looking to continue to focus on enhancing their infrastructure in areas where there's needs for infrastructure in terms of, you know, moving their trains. Although that may not necessarily address the idling issue either. I would say that in terms of trying to address that issue, it could be something where the community, and mind you, I know in some cases it may be difficult, but if the community identifies that as being a problem, to try to reach out to the railroads or the railroad that's in question here, to try to engage them on this issue, just to, you know, discuss this and talk about some of the challenges, some of the concerns that they have about the idling, and you know, maybe in some cases the railroads obviously are focused on trying, as was noted in the question, you know, to try to I guess you could say reduce costs. But I think if it's brought, you know, made a higher visibility as being an issue, and working with the railroads, the community working with the railroads, it could probably be the likelihood of being able to address the issue goes up. I don't know if that's a sufficient answer, but.
Well, in the Atlanta region, we have been using CMAQ money. CMAQ is a federal funding category. It's congestion mitigation and air quality funding, and it's got a very specific, it's actually pretty flexible, but it has to have some sort of air quality benefit. And what we've been doing is taking that money and letting the railroads purchase a genset technology, which is it's a cleaner technology for the trains, especially like in the switching yards. You know, you have the small engines that are switching trains and making trains and such. Those are generator powered as opposed to diesel powered, or at least they're dual, so they're have much less air quality impacts. So we've been using that funding category to help the railroads purchase those engines. So that might be something that could be done.
Okay. Another question for all presenters. How do you propose to reconcile potential conflicts between pedestrian needs with truck traffic needs?
I'll take a stab at that one. This is something that we definitely we're very concerned with our truck route network, and you know, we have a very strong pedestrian coalition here in Atlanta. Although you might not think it's the most pedestrian-friendly area, we do have a very strong advocacy group. First off, I will say that I don't think that accommodating trucks is, you know, exclusive to accommodating pedestrians. You can make a safe crossing for pedestrian and at the same time accommodate trucks. For example, if you do have to increase the turning radii, you can have, if it makes it a longer crossing, you can have pedestrian refuge islands. And in some cases, like the one, the example that I showed and the one that Chip showed, if there were pedestrians standing on that sidewalk while the trucks were turning, it wouldn't be unheard of if a pedestrian could get clipped by a trailer or something like that. So when you increase the turning radii and get the pedestrian out of the way, can make it safer. Now, it doesn't necessarily make it a shorter, easier crossing for pedestrians, but you can make it safe. And I think we're very concerned with the fact that, you know, we're talking about a very limited set of roadways that are generally larger roadways that are have really been built for, you know, throughput of auto traffic. And we're not talking about, you know, increasing turning radii at, you know, all sorts of side streets and collector streets in neighborhoods and in downtown and things like that. I think if you do it in a rational, measured way and accommodate the safety of the pedestrian, you can do it. But that's my two cents.
I was going to say, I think that the issue, the question about how you reconcile that, it's I think Jeff gave, or I'm sorry, Michael gave a good answer to that in terms of, you know, there's different ways you can mitigate it, you can increase safety. What I would add is I think having an understanding of where you're going to have your truck movements. The idea that you don't have to have every street or every road designed in such a way that's going to have, if you're going to have, you know, that those, especially in more urban areas, I would say, where you don't have very much truck traffic, it's side streets. It's streets that aren't going to handle truck traffic, you know, on a very rarely or never, pretty much. I mean, those streets, I don't think you need to necessarily design those streets to be so wide to accommodate trucks, because trucks aren't going to operate in those streets. The streets that are major or more significant commercial quarters in terms of, if you're talking about, you know, commercial development, you know, stores and whatnot, where there's a lot more deliveries. Obviously, if you're talking about industrial development, if you're talking about roadways that host those kinds of uses, I think it's important then to be sensitive to understanding what kind of truck volumes are actually existing, get a better handle on that, and get a sense of what the needs may be just based on existing truck traffic patterns and doing some observation, maybe doing some outreach in some cases to some of the carriers that may operate on those streets, if that is something that's feasible and it's can readily identify some of the trucks that operate on those roadways. So it's really, I think it's about being sensitive, being aware of what kind of existing truck volumes there are on different roadways, and making sure you properly design your roads or properly design your streets based on the existing land uses, which are really what's generating, quite frankly, that's what's generating the truck traffic. So being aware of that and being appropriate and being sensitive to that in your design, I think it goes a significant way. It doesn't necessarily fully solve every problem, but I think that does address the problem in a way that makes a good deal of sense.
Dwayne, just give you a chance. Is there anything else that you wanted to add to that?
I'd have to concur with Michael and Chip on that. And, you know, the only thing I would add is that, and both of them hit on this point, is that it all begins with education. Too many times when people aren't educated on the whole scope of this and the whole idea, and when you explain these things to them, they have that aha moment and say, oh, yeah, I hadn't thought about that. But when we educate folks, for the first thing that most of the general public would probably say when they saw either one of those two roads we were talking about is, oh my God, you need to ban trucks from there. That's always the first initial response, and that's not the correct response. As Michael said, you know, maybe our first priority should make it safe. If it makes it more difficult for the truck to make that turn, well, so be it. We have to have it safe first. That's the first thing. We get that out of the way. Stop the bleeding, so to speak, and then we work on improving it. And if that means it could be that we both are giving up something, maybe the truck has to go, you know, 300 feet more to make a hard turn that's more difficult, but at least now those pedestrians are safe. And I believe education, whether it be a partnership, public-private, or a three-fold through government, local governments, cities, communities, state, federal level as well, between public and private, you know, workshops offer some information out there when roads are being redesigned and rebuilt to say, this is what we have in mind, and give the public a chance to see that. And hopefully that will be some of the education that they need to say, oh, we've got to make this sustainable for both.
Okay, thank you. Well, we're about out of time. I know we still have a few unanswered questions, and I'll attempt to get some written responses from the presenters that will be sent out with the follow-up information. But thank you, everybody, for all your great questions, and thank you to our three presenters for three very interesting presentations. I will send out an email once the recording from today, the transcript, and the presentations are available online. The next seminar will be held on July 20th and will be on freight facility impact fees. The seminar is not yet available for registration. Hopefully it will be in the next few days, and I'll send out a notice through the freight planning listserv once it is available. As a reminder, if you are an AICP member and you're applying for certification maintenance credits for today, The seminar is not yet listed on the AICP website, but I will also send out an email to everybody who registered once it is available. So with that, thank you, everybody. I encourage you to join the Freight Planning Listserv if you haven't already done so, as that's how we advertise most of these seminars. Thank you to all three presenters, and everybody enjoy the rest of your day.